My name is Richard Bush. I'm the director of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies. And it's my great privilege to convene today's session on a new and important book by our friends Ralph Hassig and Katie Oh called The Hidden People of North Korea. I'd like to start with a methodological point. There have been a number of humanitarian catastrophes in the 20th century. The Ukrainian famine, the Holocaust in Central and Eastern Europe, autogenocide in Cambodia, and North Korea in general come to mind. The interesting thing about many of these catastrophes is that the world actually had information about them in fairly real time, whether it was farmers from Ukraine or Jewish refugees from Germany and other places, Cambodian refugees on the Thai border. And there was a tendency sometimes to not believe what these people were saying because they appeared to have sort of self-interested reasons for doing so. Maybe people didn't want to believe that such horrors could occur. But we learned over that experience that refugees and defectors are actually very good sources of information, and that you should trust what they say. Whether you can act on that information is another question, but you shouldn't deny what they say. This book, The Hidden People of North Korea, takes refugee and defector accounts very seriously. And it constructs a picture of life in North Korea from them. And we need to take it very seriously and sort of adjust our view of North Korea based on it. With that, I would like to call on my friend and colleague, Roberta Cohen, to say a few words of introduction, and then we'll move to our authors. Thank you. Roberta?
Excuse me while I switch glasses. Good morning, everyone. It gives me great pleasure to participate in this launch of a new book by Ralph Hassig and Katie Oh. I have admired their work for many years and feel they contribute a great deal to scholarship on North Korea. Because Katie's family comes from North Korea, she has an edge on understanding the mentality and culture of the North, in addition to being a noted analyst of political and economic developments of both Koreas. Ralph brings expertise in social psychology, consumer psychology, and organizational behavior to the study of North Korea. Not being Korean, he also brings the distance needed for effective analysis. Their new study, The Hidden People of North Korea, Everyday Life in the Hermit Kingdom, is a direct challenge to Kim Jong-il and his regime. In the opening to the book, Kim is quoted as saying, "We must envelop our environment in a dense fog to prevent our enemies from learning anything about us." Hassig and Oh slowly but surely lift that mountain of fog and misinformation surrounding North Korea. The authors may have been refused entry to the country, but they do a painstaking and extraordinary job of ferreting out in 253 pages the most detailed information about life in North Korea and who its leaders are. They rely on defectors in the South, who now number more than 16,000, on other North Koreans, Asian specialists of North Korea, and a broad range of Korean and English language sources. The result is an almost encyclopedic picture of what life is like in North Korea and how the people cope with the policies and practices of this hermetically sealed regime. What I found new and interesting in the book is the description of how this regimented and controlled system is eroding. It documents the cracks that are developing in the ideological, economic, and political foundations of the regime. It also shows that this erosion is becoming apparent to more and more people in the government, in the elite class, and among others as well. The consequences of that erosion, however, are not so clear, making for intense debate internationally. There are a number of observers, for example, who believe that even with this erosion and the death of Kim Jong-il, the system, the party, the military, the government bureaucracy, the state security, will remain largely intact. Yet at a meeting in Brookings 2 weeks ago, North Korean defector Kim Kwang-jin, a former member of the elite class, expressed the view that a successor regime would not be able to maintain the failed policies of Kim Jong-il. It would not have the same authority and therefore might have to become more accountable to the population. In his view, there would be a process of reform, the opening up of North Korea, and the dissolution of socialism. Still others anticipate the collapse of the regime, even anarchy, necessitating international involvement. Hasek and Oh can comment on where they stand in this debate. I would put them somewhere in the middle. On the one hand, their book points out that given the many cracks in the system, North Korea, in some respects, has already collapsed. But the collapse has gone unnoticed because it happened gradually and out of the view of foreigners. They describe a slow transition from socialism to capitalism and show how the government's information monopoly is eroding. In recent years, North Koreans, especially privileged North Koreans, have been secretly able to listen to foreign radio and television broadcasts and watch smuggled videos and DVDs of affluent life in South Korea. Cell phones and computers are making their way into the country as well, although internet access is severely restricted. Nonetheless, technology is trumping North Korea's seclusion. But on the other hand, Hasek and Oh point to a great deal of stability and organization in North Korea. They underscore how much social cohesion there is and how North Koreans generally hide any thoughts of disaffection. Indeed, most do not even think about politics at all, the book says, focusing instead on economic survival. Part of the co-author's confidence in the strength and stability of the system comes from their own and others' mistaken earlier prediction at the time Kim Il-sung died that Kim Jong-il's rule would be short. But the situation may really be different now. Perhaps too much erosion has taken place for maintenance of the same failed policies. Perhaps North Koreans are more clear-eyed than we give them credit for. Hasek and Oh seem quite persuaded that just as Kim Jong-il long benefited from the international community's support and largesse, a successor regime with policies not that different from Kim Jong-il will also receive international support, given the nuclear card it holds. In their view, for a variety of political, strategic, and economic reasons, outside powers will not allow anarchy to overtake North Korea. What the United States should do, the two authors recommend, is to bypass the government and target the North Korean people with information about their society and the outside world so that they can decide on the changes to make in their own future. I would probably give more weight than the two authors do to the potential impact on the North Korean authorities of international human rights diplomacy and advocacy, were such initiatives ever to really be taken. Because the book is effective in peeling away layers of official obfuscation, the North Korean government will probably consider it one more sling and arrow of hostile propaganda. Recently, the North Korean government submitted a report to the United Nations on its human rights record. As you may know, the UN will be conducting a review of the North Korean record on December 7th in Geneva. The North Korean government, in its report to the UN, presents its country as having a vibrant civil society, the rule of law, free expression, political parties, 480 newspapers and hundreds of magazines, and a near-perfect human rights record. It blames the United States for any internal dissatisfaction. Indeed, it charges the United States with inciting North Korea's citizens to overthrow their government by radio broadcasts and other means. This hypersensitivity to outside information that differs from its own version of events makes it important that the United States, other governments, and NGOs respond at the UN review with information that counters the report. I would strongly recommend that the Hasig Oh book be translated into Korean immediately and distributed at the UN and to as many North Koreans as possible. Radio Free Asia, The Voice of America, and other broadcasters should publicize the book because it contains so much information the population should hear about. Let them be the judge. North Koreans have a right to know more than what they are currently told, and we have a responsibility to make sure that they hear it. Katie and Ralph, bravo on your book.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roberta. Well, why don't we now get to the main event and invite Ralph to make a few remarks.
I want to thank Richard and Roberta for their kind introduction and also thank the Brookings staff for hosting this meeting today. And thank you for showing up and showing your interest in North Korea, because the North Korean people can use all the help they can get, I think. My task is going to be to give you a brief overview, an additional brief overview of the book, tell you what the chapters are, the main point in each chapter. And then Katie will follow with remarks, whose content I don't even know at this point. And then we'll be available for any questions you may have. So we've got the hidden people of North Korea, and by hidden people we're referring to almost all the North Korean people, not just a little segment. They're hidden by their regime, Kim Jong-il, and before that Kim Il-sung, for two purposes. One, to keep the North Korean people from finding out what's going on in the outside world and comparing their lot with the lot of others. And second, they're trying to keep the outside world from finding out what's going on in North Korea. So even the North Korean telephone book is considered a classified document. Although, like many classified documents nowadays, with all the corruption in North Korea, it's been leaked out, so we know what's in the book, and it's not very interesting anyway. I think there's at least three main points I want to make about the whole book before talking about each individual chapter. The first is that in our opinion, North Korea is Kim Jong-il's kingdom. It's his property. That's what the country's for. And North Korea over the last 60 years has been both intelligently designed and it has evolved to support the Kim family. That's what it's there for. The third point is that North Korea, like any country, is a system. The different parts relate fairly well to each other, the economy, the politics, human rights policies, military policies. So I would not expect that one part of North Korea will change without affecting all the other parts. And the fact that there are interlocking parts of North Korea, the fact that it's a system, means that it's relatively resistant to change. I would not expect big changes in North Korea's human rights policies until there are changes in its politics at the highest level. I would not expect change in their nuclear weapons policy until there are changes at the highest level, because it all, in my opinion, all fits together. The first chapter is just an introduction. We call it the illusion of unity. In any country, you'd like to have unity, especially when you're under threat, and the North Koreans always feel that they're under threat from the outside world. In North Korea's case, it's not nationalism as the unifying principle. It's loyalty to the Kim family, specifically now Kim Jong-il. So it's a little different kind of unity than we usually think of. And Kim is identified with the country. I have a little quote here. Sometimes the North Korean propagandists express themselves in poetry even. This is from Nodong Shimun, the party newspaper, a few years ago. And he says, "You fought off the raging storm and gave us faith, Comrade Kim Jong-il. But for you, we wouldn't be here. But for you, the fatherland wouldn't be here either." Okay, so identifying the whole country with one person. And, of course, the first duty of every North Korean is to protect the leader. Somewhere down the line is the duty to protect the country. First, protect the leader. So you will see in the book that we spend a lot of time talking about Kim and the Kim regime, because I think that's the center of North Korea today. Unfortunately, in North Korea, the unity that they seek is an illusion, because it's supposed to be unity around Kim Jong-il. But just when he took over from his father in 1994 was when the economy was taking a decided downturn. It had been in trouble before, but really took a hit in the mid-90s. And the North Korean people associate Kim Jong-il, with bad economic times. And it's very hard to unite around failure. So for the most part, I think the people ignore Kim as much as they can, as much as you can ignore any dictator. But they don't exhibit this unity that the propagandists keep boasting about. Now, the next chapter, the first substantial chapter in the book, is devoted to the life of the leader, Kim Jong-il. It's Kim's country. He has a very bad reputation, as I said, among many North Koreans because of the economic hardships. It's an irony, really, because he's just following in his father's footsteps. All the policies were set by Kim Il-sung, and he's just doing what his father taught him to do. Yet people are blaming him. Different circumstances have led to different results, and now he has to find some way out of the situation, and there is nothing. North Korea is in such bad shape that I don't see how it's going to fix itself. Kim himself, the important person, lives like a king. I mean, he travels from mansion to mansion around the country. We don't know. He's got probably hundreds of millions of dollars he can tap in. Actually, the whole country's income is his if he wants it, I suppose. So we shouldn't expect that Kim Jong-il needs foreign aid. His people badly need it, but they'll only get as much as he allows them to have. But if we come to him and say, we'll give you this much economic aid if you give up, say, your nuclear weapons, he probably says to himself, I don't need any more money. What do I want? In fact, a lot of economic foreign aid can mean people coming into the country, opening up, and that's exactly what he doesn't want, I think. He wants to keep the people hidden. He's a very intelligent man. You know, the press often says he's crazy or something. No, no, no. I mean, you can't stay in power this long and be crazy. He's very smart. He knows what he's doing. And he's a great success at what he does, which is staying in power. He's not in good health, apparently. He had apparently had that stroke in August of last year, and it's taking him some time to recover, and he may have other ailments. So there's been as you probably know, there's been a succession campaign going on last year, and especially the first half of this year. successor really has to come from the Kim family, which is the propagandists have said is a special family, a special revolutionary family. No other family in North Korea like it. So it's almost got to be one of his three sons, and it looks now like it's going to be the youngest of the three, who's only 26, Kim Jong-un. He hasn't been introduced yet formally to the North Korean people. The North Korean press, for example, doesn't put his picture. In fact, we haven't even seen a photograph of him since he was a little boy. But apparently, in fact, in lectures like party lectures that are given to groups of people, workers, military, and so forth, he's been introduced by name. And he's referred to often as the Morning Star General. And recently, some lecture material was apparently legitimate lecture material was smuggled out of North Korea. One of the Japanese newspapers, I think Asahi maybe, got a hold of it. And it looks legitimate to me because it's 12 pages long and very repetitious, and that's kind of what North Korean propaganda is like. And I read through all 12 pages. And all I could make out in terms of the young son's qualifications for being a leader, other than that he's from the Kim family, is that he is a good military map maker. They keep mentioning this over and over. He makes good military maps, and he's credited with staging the fireworks display this year for the birthdays of Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung. So assuming he wants to continue the military first policies of his father, these are maybe reasonable qualifications. But other than that, we don't know what he's done. He's a real mystery. That's how the North Koreans like it. We turn next to a chapter on the economy, and I really want to skip over that because most of its background, you're probably aware of how bad the North Korean economy is. Statistics you can't necessarily trust, but it's unquestionably it's bad. And as I said, I don't see any prospect for economic improvement. I don't know where North Korea would find the resources. They can't lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. So I would expect the situation to continue to be very bad for a long time. It's going to take hundreds of billions of dollars of foreign assistance, aid, investment to help North Korea recover. What we're more interested in the book is the everyday economy, how people deal with this. What do you do if your economy is in a permanent depression year after year, decade after decade? And the logical answer is you try to start your own economy, and that's what the North Korean people have done, of course, in the last few years, since the late 1990s. Everyone goes into business for himself or herself at least part-time, because if you wait for the government to give you food, you're probably going to starve as maybe as many as a million people or even more died in the late 90s. There's very few food rations being distributed. Government wages are almost worthless. I mean, if you wanted to exchange your North Korean won that you've gotten in wages for dollars, you'd make something like $2 a month or something like that. You can't feed yourself on North Korean wages. So everyone's going into business for themselves. But it's very small business. For the most part, and you'll see, and we have a few photographs in the book of women. It's easier for the women to get away from their assigned workplace than it is for men. Women sitting at the roadside with a few fish or pieces of fruit or a bottle or two of homemade liquor, and just sitting there on the ground, hoping to sell it, hoping to make a few pennies. For the majority of North Koreans, I think that's the nature of their economy today. Not much better than that. So you live from day to day, week to week, maybe month to month. The top cadres and bureaucrats can sell their influence through bribery and make a lot more money. Teachers can earn money by tutoring. Doctors can earn money by making medicines and selling it because the medical system is pretty much out of medicine. People can hire themselves out, day laborers. Can earn looks like 1 or 2,000 North Korean won a day, just standing on street corners like we see here in Washington and hiring themselves out. Where if they worked at their office or factory, they'd earn maybe 6,000 North Korean won a month. So it's much more profitable than going to work. Everyone is in business for themselves. A lot of the selling, buying and selling is done at marketplaces, which the government condones. Kim Jong-il is not at all happy with those marketplaces because it means that people are dealing outside the government system. But for now, at least, the regime is accepting this as necessary, although there's always restrictions put on them. And this year, they've put in on some extra restrictions about the ages of people who can sell in the market and so forth. I would expect that there's maybe an equilibrium here, a balance. So I'm not really looking for a great expansion of the markets in the next few years, but I'm not expecting that they're going to close the markets either. It's sort of an uneasy relationship now between the government and its centrally controlled economy and the people's economy. The next chapter is information environment, and the logic here is that if you're struggling to make a living, struggling to stay alive, just doing it day to day isn't going to get you anywhere. You really would like to have some plan. You know, how can I make my life better and get some guarantee that I'll survive, my family will survive? And to make a plan, you really need information. And so we looked at what information is available to the North Korean people. And there's really two information environments, as you might guess. One is the official environment of propaganda. That doesn't change from year to year. It's the same themes. North Korea, even with the hardships, is the best place to live, is the only place that people are truly free. Kim Jong-il is the greatest leader in the world. All the other countries of the world are discriminating against North Korea, and some, like the United States, are trying to stifle North Korea and enslave the North Korean people. This is the usual propaganda. But because life is so hard, even though propaganda says this is the best place to live, people have turned their backs on the propaganda and ignore it as much as possible. They still have to listen to all the party lectures, but they don't really pay attention to it. What they pay attention to is the information in the other unofficial information environment made up. Roberta mentioned some of these sources here as videotapes and DVDs and so forth being smuggled into North Korea from China, radio broadcasts from stations such as Radio Free Asia, Voice of America, some South Korean stations, some religious stations. A lot of North Koreans go over to China for a short period of time to do a little trading. They come back. They tell their friends, neighbors, relatives what they've seen. Rumors start circulating in the country. So I think today most North Koreans know something about the outside world. It's not a coherent picture, but they've got some ideas of what's going on out there. And this is, as I'm going to say in a minute, is what I'd like to promote in greater detail, more information for the North Korean people. What they do with that, I'm not sure. But right now, I think they're puzzled. They don't believe the propaganda, and they're getting glimpses of the outside world, but that's not what they've been taught all their lives. So what should we believe? And the next chapter actually is belief. That's not the title. I forget the title. But it's about what the North Korean people believe based on this information that's filtering into the country and the information they've been given all their lives. Of course, we don't have any public opinion polls for North Korea, so we rely mostly on defector testimony. And we quite a lot of reliance in that, I think. What we gather, and a lot of surveys have been done in South Korea of defectors. There are now, I think, over 17,000 defectors in South Korea. A lot of surveys of that. And there's quite a bit of consistency, I think, in the survey results. The picture that we get is that the people, as Roberta mentioned, are really mostly focusing on the here and now. They're just trying to make it through the week, make it through the month. They don't have any big political ideas. It's dangerous to have political ideas, of course, in North Korea. So they don't have any firm beliefs that could guide them into the future. They've heard that China and South Korea are richer than North Korea, which has got to be puzzling to them because they always were told that the South Koreans were actually slaves of the Americans, and they've always looked down on the Chinese. And now they know, these people have more than we do. Something's gone wrong here. Something's gone very wrong. I don't think they realize how much foreign aid they get, but they know they get some, which contradicts the traditional Juche self-reliance policy. They blame Kim Jong-il for some of this, but they also maybe even more blame bureaucrats, saying, well, maybe if those bureaucrats did what Kim Jong-il and his father had told them to do, we'd be in better shape. And they blame foreigners. Certainly they blame Americans and Japanese. Even from birth, I think there's quite a strong anti-Americanism in North Korea. Even from birth, children are told to hate Americans, taught to hate Americans. We have a few passages in the book. One, for example, we have a little reading textbook for first grade students in North Korea. And one of the lessons to teach them how to read is it shows some little boys playing with a toy tank. Mini tank advances. Our tank advances. Crushing American bastards. Mini tank advances. This is the first grade. And in fact, bastards is pretty much the usual suffix anytime Americans are mentioned. It's like their last name, American bastards. And the same goes for the Japanese. Japanese bastards, like same family. For that matter, they don't much like the Chinese or the Russians either. Okay? They're really kind of isolated people. I mean, that's a threatening world out there, which is good for Kim Jong-il because it means the only person looking out for them, the only person standing in the way of, you know, those foreigners who want to come in and get us is our Kim Jong-il. And sure enough, no foreigners have invaded North Korea since the Kims took power. So I think this is what Kim likes, and I think it supports his regime. I'm going to pretty much skip over the following chapter, which is on law, political class, and human rights. We know about the dismal human rights situation in North Korea, and Roberta certainly has spoken about this. I just want to suggest that those human rights policies are absolutely part of the ruling regime. They're not an accident. They're not an aberration. They're not something that could easily be changed. The human rights policies are a tool of the regime, just as the law is a tool of the regime. Kim Jong-il and the party come first. Then we have a chapter, next to the last chapter is on defectors. And again, I want to skip over that fairly quickly because we know a lot of defectors have come down to North Korea. There's even more in China. The easy part is getting into China. A little bribe and you're across the river. The difficult part is getting out of China because nowadays about the only good way to do it is to go down to Southeast Asia, to Thailand. That's a long trip. So surveys have shown that most North Koreans who defect to South Korea have lived in China, hidden away in China, away from the police, for 1, 2, 3 years or more. They stay there a long time. It's a very tough life for them. Through the 1990s, through the whole 1990s, the number of defectors was only 533. And then the number increased. In the last few years, it's been between 2,500 and 3,000 a year getting to South Korea. And this year, the latest we heard was 2,100 through the end of September. They hardly receive any notice anymore because it's just a steady stream coming in. Once they get to South Korea, they face further hardships because they're not ready to live in a democratic market economy. The very high unemployment rate, a lot of dissatisfaction, and that tells us something about what's going to happen when North and South Korea finally unify. Final chapter is about the end of North Korea question mark. The end comes slowly is the title we use. My conclusion is that North Korea is very poor, but it's stable. The people are not satisfied, but being dissatisfied isn't what causes revolutions. You've got to have some alternative. And I think the Kim regime has been very successful in keeping alternatives away from the people. There's not really any civil society. There's Kim regime and the party, and there's lots of individuals, not much else. And I would not expect anything like a revolution, even though times are tough in North Korea. So no pressure from inside the country to remove the Kim regime or make it change, and no pressure from outside either. The Chinese certainly support North Korea. They sometimes say things, you know, about the North Korea's nuclear program, but I don't think we should take this too seriously. They definitely support the North Korean regime. The United States doesn't talk about regime change anymore. So really, there's not going to be anyone outside who wants to see a change. They prefer to see stability. Bad as the situation is for the North Korean people, they prefer North Korea to be stable than to take a chance on some sort of collapse and refugees running all over the place and hundreds of billions of dollars of aid needed. So we think that the situation will continue for some time. And that leads to the final question, should we do anything about it? And we offer the same policy suggestions we did 10 years ago in our first book, which are not likely to be adopted. Namely, let's give the North Koreans as much information as we can and let them decide what to do about it, difficult as it will be for them. There hasn't been that much of an effort to send information to North Korea. I mentioned some of the ways. Radio Free Asia, I think it's only about 5 hours of Radio Free Asia and 5 hours of Voice of America broadcasting per day into North Korea. We've been very reluctant, I think, to push any harder on that because, as I said, our government doesn't want regime change right now either. What I'd like to see is more of an attempt to get information into North Korea. There's lots of ways you could do it. You could be creative. Our government's not very good at information dissemination, of course. I mean, you'd have to bring in Madison Avenue. Madison Avenue is very good at that. But make a more concerted attempt to tell the North Korean people what's going on in the outside world and also what their government is actually doing or not doing for them. In our dealings, I would like as much as possible for us to deal directly with the North Korean people and avoid the regime. That's difficult to do, of course. But the more we deal with the regime, especially at high level and high level talks and so forth, I think the more legitimacy we give to it. And the people see, oh, these presidents and secretaries and so forth are coming to talk to Kim Jong-il. He must be pretty good after all, or they wouldn't come. So I would prefer information aid, if we can get it as, you know, directly as possible to North Korean people, I think that would be good. Strengthen them because they are, I think, in competition with their government. So let me stop here, and then we'll see what Katie has to say about the book and maybe how it was written. She might even want to contradict me at points. I don't know.
Well, I'm actually in a very luxurious position as the last speaker, since Richard, Roberta, and Ralph, the three R's, took care of the most important part of the presentation today. I want to thank again everybody again to come here today to listen to this North Korean story, our book. And I also again called Eileen, Kevin, and Richard to stage this. This is the first debut of our book because I'm a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings. I don't want to give this presentation to other organization, even though I have my own Korea club, but that will be the second meeting. But lastly, I also would like to thank to Dr. Ralph Hessig, who is the first author and my hidden partner of North Korean research. I think this is his first time to be at Brookings, as a matter of fact, for the past 2 decades, who happens to be actually my husband. And he was the one who pushed the book project while I was working for the government task, Senate Gazillion Works, and he had the hard work to bear the chunk of the writing and organizing the book, so my thanks goes to him. North Korea has been my pain, my passion, and my profession since I became an accidental North Korean analyst. I went to Berkeley 1979 at the age of 30, so you can guess how old I am. I was born in 1949, less than a year before the Korean War. My parents came from North Korea, but I was born actually in the South. But in Korea, your parents' hometown considered to be your hometown. And at the age of 30, I came to Berkeley because everybody said it's a great school and you can have emancipation of your intellectual life and your kind of yoke of the growing up in very conservative and male chauvinistic Korean society. And I was very glad to study for the first time Chinese politics, Japanese politics, and Russian politics. But since I was Korean, my professors called me to serve them as a research assistant with assistant with a special ability in speaking Korean very fluently. And I thought, oh, my God, the boring North Korean propaganda material. And that's the kind of beginning of my becoming an accidental North Korean specialist. And several months ago, I was cleaning my office since our second book is done, and we thought that this would be our last full serious reference footnoted book because it almost killed us. And I was cleaning, and I found my 1981, my notes for the Professor Scalapino of UC Berkeley. And it was all handwritten beautifully, first Nodong Shinmun or whatever North Korean document material, and then the side column, painstakingly with a clear, beautiful English writing with my hand about the interpretation and implication for the Professor Scalapino. And if you cover it, you can actually use it today. So I was really fascinated by the interesting consistency of North Korean propaganda material. If you remember, since the first nuclear crisis in the early 1990s and 1994 agreed framework, United States have been pretty much preoccupied with the nuclear issues. We wrote actually our first book, North Korea Through the Looking Glass, published proudly by Brookings in October 2000. And for the last chapter, we titled it Dealing with the DPRK. And in that chapter, several ways to deal with North Korea were suggested, because then the Richard Haass, the Foreign Policy Program Director, currently the President of the Council on Foreign Relations, asked us that, Katie, Brookings is not an academic campus, but you have to add policy options for the book. And I told him adding the policy options for the U.S. government is almost like a kiss of death, because nothing will be accepted by the government, but nonetheless we added it. But even though we earnestly wrote with our full objective and fairness, none of the policies seem to be accepted. So I should say that the comprehensive book that covered from history to the military, the situation of North Korea, was widely read and pretty much appreciated, but we decided we should write another book. And this time our focus is not nukes, not the military regimentation, but North Korean people. I must say that today, you can say a couple of things as a common, very common common sense. Maybe you can agree with me, or maybe only a minority disagrees. That is that, number one, the Kim regime's nuclear program will always be with us, and U.S. policy options for removing the nuclear weapons and materials are very limited, and people are waiting for Kim regime to go away with wishful thinking. And finally, Kim Jong-il's survival strategy continues with good calculation and patience, one commodity that Americans has less than North Koreans. Inside North Korea, I also would like to offer the situation in 2009. 2009 compared with 1994, what are the differences? Number one, Kim Jong-il is almost 15 years older than before and 30 years less healthy. Two, North Koreans have learned to make a living without the regime, but they are still under tight control, political control. And third, the North Korean elites have also learned how to be capitalists without telling Kim Jong-il, while supporting Kim's version of socialism, at least on the front and for the public. And number four, foreigners know more about North Korea thanks to defectors and cellular phones, as well as intelligence. And if you would like to find out the currency rate today, actually I could one of my sources in South Korea, defector, and then he can immediately call Northern China, and he can call his sister brother in different parts of North Korea, and I can get the currency rates of Wonsan, Saryeon, Nampo, maybe in less than 20 minutes. Number five, the regime has more nuclear material and weapons and missiles. And finally, the U.S. is more vigilant about foreign threats after 9/11. Today, as a matter of fact, we are pursuing, with or without any intention, maybe, the policy of 4D, I call it, U.S. government I'm talking about. Seemingly dialogue with North Korea or regional powers. Dialogue is always good. If possible, always sit down with North Korea. Soon, our first important person, special coordinator, Stephen Bosworth will be in Pyongyang. And number two, diplomacy, to persuade the U.S. public, at least the U.S. is doing something, and also talk to regional powers. But dialogue diplomacy don't make us to reach the goal of a nuclear resolution. So what you do, the third D is to detect what is going on inside North Korea, outside North Korea, and especially on its WMDs and tradings. And finally, all this fail, in that case, you deter, deterrence. So basically today we live with the policy of four Ds, although none of the government members will pronounce it with confidence. Meanwhile, most North Koreans continue starving and struggling to survive. I always lose weight when I go to Korea to interview defectors. After 10 days of defector interviews, I came back with a little bit thinner KD, and I sometimes have a lot of nightmare to think about their lifestyle. And I actually was in Germany from the summer of 1990 to 1991, experiencing the incredible drastic situation in two Germanies. We attended, Ralf and I went to the Koblenz and attended the German unification ceremony, and I was maybe the only one who was crying. And I thought that that national drama of Germany will be played in South Korea pretty soon. My father, who came from North Korea, when I was in Germany, suddenly had a stroke, although he was very lightweight, and his nickname was White Gandhi. But he died suddenly, and I happened to be very lucky to fly out and saw him on his last deathbed. And I told my father, "Father, I will not work for private sector to make money or go to the academic campus only focusing on theory, but I will stay inside the Washington Beltway politics, although I hate it every day, and particularly working for the DOD, because of military is the operator and implementer. If something happens in drastic situation in Korean Peninsula, I'll work for the think tank, working for the Office of Secretary of Defense, to work toward the Korean unification." He could not speak then already, but he loved me as his first daughter, and he was my intellectual godfather. He clapped my hand so tightly, and then he let it go twice, three times, and signaling that he heard me, and doctor said he understood what you said. So as Ralf and I were working for the last 7 years on this book, we really thought that what should we do in terms of giving some ways and pathways for the North Koreans to face some freedom and happiness. And our book is about North Korean people, because I believe North Koreans have the same DNA like South Koreans. If we give them the information and tools, and then maybe as South Koreans, because I grew up in dictatorship government, had a choice, option to fight against government and change the dictatorial military regime to a democratic, incredibly beautiful modern society, I think sharing the same DNA, North Koreans will do the same. And that's the reason why we wrote the book. So thank you again to be here and with us.
Thank you, Ralf. Thank you, Katie, for your presentations. The floor is now open. If I call on you, please wait for the mic and then identify yourselves and your affiliation, if any, and we'll go from there. The gentleman right here.
My name is Judd Harriet. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I wondered if you could speak more to the elites in North Korea. Who are they? And you also mentioned that Kim Jong-il has a bad reputation, not so good a reputation, because of his association with the economic downturn in 94. I assume that's predominant amongst the elites. Maybe you could talk more about the elites. Who are they, what they do, how they communicate with each other, so forth and so on. Thank you.
I'll let Katie handle some of that. Let me just say that we rather extensively discuss some of the film that you made several years ago about North Korea, and you'll find that in the book, and it was very helpful. Do you want to address who the elites are?
Well, first of all, if you go to the Brookings website, there is a special report that I was a task leader, and the Ralph and also Ken Gao is today here presenting the 7 experts on North Korean study presented a different chapter on North Korean elites. And depending on how you would narrow it, define really core elite that is like, let's say, Kim Jong-il's kitchen cabinet, really the about 100 maybe who are really involved in the national decision-making. That's really core of the core. But if you stretch over to the provincial level, county level, party cadre, top the managers, they can be all called, can be called elite, which can reach, you can congregate maybe, say, about up to 8,000. But then, if you want to enhance a little bit, like in a normal American society, anybody who graduates from college, anybody who has a technical background and professional interest in the national statehood, and then involved in the professional work, that can be also different from ordinary people. So in that case, that can reach up to maybe several 100,000 people. So depending on where you are standing, elite can be defined very differently. So I strongly suggest that you go for that. At this point today, only one thing that I would like to add is that the elite is most well-informed and aware of the both internal and external situation of North Korea. And they are the ones maybe who could make some changes. But also the elite can be the worst bunch in terms of cowardice and corruption. They don't want to lift a finger to kill themselves first and their families. So they are the maybe the people who knew, have all the knowledge, but and yet they seem to be most loyal. So in a sense that by delivering the information I'm talking about from ordinary level to the elite level, if there is some linkage between elite and ordinary people, there might be some interesting changes. So we can talk about more later.
Let me add just 2 sentences on that. If we're interested in who the elite decision makers are, I think the group is very small, clustered around Kim Jong-il. If we're interested in which people want to support the current regime because it's in their best interest, then I think it could, say, Katie said, could go to 100,000, maybe a couple of million people. 2 ways to look at it.
Let me break for a commercial. The book is going to be on sale outside.
It's like TV.
Right here.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. Ralph, I was struck by something you said at the tail end of your recommendation portion. You said, the more we engage with the regime, the more legitimacy we give it. It does seem like the Obama administration is going to re-engage. A matter of time, the announcement may even come today. Knowing what you know and what collectively we in the United States know from the past several administrations' dealings with North Korea on and off, since we are going to go ahead and engage with North Korea, at least on the nuclear issue, what do you recommend? Broadening the dialogue? What would your idea of smart engagement, effective engagement, be?
Well, that's fairly high level anyway, but that's what the Obama administration wants. And I have a lot of sympathy for other governments like the American government, because if they don't do anything, the American people say, why don't you do something about those North Korean nuclear weapons you say threaten us? So for political reasons, we've got to engage. I'm in favor of talking, presenting our point of view and saying, you know this, but I'm presenting it again. Now you tell me what you think. I think I know it, but you say it. Beyond that, since I don't see any way that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear weapons, I'm very leery of any more agreements, like the 1994 agreements and some that were made, you know, in 2006 and around there. Just talk. Just go and talk to them. I kind of wish we'd talk in a third country so we don't have to go over there and you know, make them come over here or make them go down to Singapore or something like that.
But if I may follow, food aid, do you think food aid is food appropriate?
If we can monitor it so we're sure that most of it goes to the people and it's identified as coming from the United States, yes.
I would only comment that Jeff Bader from the National Security Council spoke here on Friday last week, and he's laid out a set of conditions concerning whether we would truly re-engage with North Korea. One can ask whether North Korea is ever going to be willing to meet those conditions. I think one of the reasons for being willing to go the extra mile and send Steve Bosworth on yet another trip to Pyongyang is to demonstrate to other countries, particularly China, that the problem is not us. Who has the next question? Back here.
Thank you. Joshua Leibs from Radio Free Asia. I was wondering what your opinion is of information exchanges that might be viewed as less hostile by the regime, such as cultural exchanges. What kind of research were you able to pull together in terms of cultural exchanges?
One specific example being like, what, the Syracuse University or something? Or what sort of exchange are you thinking about?
Well, the Philharmonic, for instance, you know, that type of, it's another way maybe to win over the hearts and minds that might be something that the regime allows in.
What do you think, Katie?
Well, at the first book, as I said, dealing with the DPRK, we suggested the multilateral, really all directional, different engagement, let the engagement be like a 100 flower blooms sort of situation. And then the dynamic, diverse, different approaches by everybody, regional powers, U.S., private sector, academics and think tanks and the sportsmen and the rock star. And it's good the more we engage. Having said that, somehow that the North Koreans has played such a great displayed great skill to be a rare commodity, I should say, like selecting, accepting, and then letting the people come in. Just not everybody, like let's say all of you would like to go to North Korea just for the heck of it, to see North Korea. None of you will get maybe only about 0%, 1% will get visa. So because of that, the engaging partners like Syracuse University or anybody always kind of like a victim in a sense that North Koreans set the conditions. We do this. And then the other side of it really has to follow that, like almost nagging and kneeling and please accept us, please. So somehow I think, as a Korean say, when you start with the wrong button about hitting your clothes, you just ended up having a wrong clothes, in a sense that the engagement has been played in the hands of North Korea. But I still believe that to deliver the information, we gotta engage, and all of us has to be very creatively come up with some ideas. We are every night over dinner with a glass of wine. What can be done to deliver more? And maybe that could be our next 100 ways to deliver information will be our next book.
Back in the back.
Rob Warren from the Foreign Service Institute. Thank you for an excellent presentation. I wanted to ask you about the role of South Korea vis-a-vis the North. It seems to me that, yes, we can play a greater role in information, perhaps in aid, but it's South Korea that I think can have the greatest impact. And would you care to discuss that?
Well, you're absolutely right. And of course, we went through 10 years when the South Korean government didn't want to even criticize the North Korean government at all. So there was very little that the South Korean government did, and they didn't let the South Korean people do anything. Now, you know, we have the balloon drops, for example. That's the most dramatic thing, where some religious groups and human rights groups are sending flights of balloons over North Korea with everything from little Bibles to information to some money and candies and so forth, and which tells the North Korean people what's going on, at least in South Korea. I'm all in favor of this, and I wish there were more, and I wish the United States maybe would even think along those lines. But even now, the South Korean government is a little concerned about that. I can understand the South Korean government doesn't want unification in the near term. It would be an economic disaster. So anything that might get the North Korean people excited, which includes foreign information, I think the South Korean government even is a bit concerned about. I wish they weren't so concerned.
I'll go a little bit philosophical on South Korea's role. South Korea has the best brains and resources and analytical powers and the intelligence sources than anybody else. They
when
speak
it comes to North
yes,
Korea.
When it comes to North Korea, they speak same language. They are close, and if one good thing coming out of the 10 years of Sunshine Policy is that so many bureaucrats and traders and diplomats and businessmen, academicians went to North Korea and then showed that how South Koreans can be very westernized and can be very rich and can be very generous. And North Koreans, of course, charge the arm and a leg going into the stupid karaoke. They charge per entry fee about $100. Nonetheless, Koreans willingly, well, what the heck, they need some money and they dropped it. So some of the, like, this spoiling process that North Koreans educated by South Korean presence and contact. So that was good. But I think the South Korea domestically, I think they should really show the, some kind of like a spirit of reconciliation and embracement, like Nelson Mandela did after the apartheid and his jailing and coming out as a national leader. If you look at the South Korean politics, all the presidents were sent to a prison and they will be purged and dead or committing suicide. If you think about the North Koreans trying to reconcile and having a little bit of exchanges of South Koreans, they may say, oops. If we become a third-rate citizen in South Korea, they will butcher us, and then they will be purged of every bloody finger that we put maybe in the jar, that will be all finger cut. So South Korean politics itself has to go through some of the improvement to really become a much more embracing. And how they, what about the treatment of defectors? I tried to introduce one of the beautiful women who had a nutritional health degree from North Korea. She left her 6-year-old child, and she was working as a dishwasher of the barbecue shop, barbecue restaurant. So much beer and the beef and everything they consume, and then every night she has to wash those dishes with the piled up food, and she couldn't stand it. She had a bloody memory of her starving son. And so when I interviewed her, I said, you look very smart, and are you happy with the current job? And she said, no, I'm not. I really would not like to touch the leftover food anymore. It kills me. I say, why? Because it reminds me of my starving boy in North Korea. So I said, what kind of degree you have? She has a technical degree of nutrition and health science. I said, all right. And very coincidentally, Korean woman who owned a beautiful luxurious cafe serving the cappuccino frappuccino, sort of Starbucks of Korean version, said, Katie, do you know any great woman who can be manager? I said, yes. When I introduced her, she almost slapped my face, said, I cannot use the defector. They could be liar and murderer. I said, because of your kind of person, there will be no real true engagement. So then finally she hired her. She's now booming manager, scouted by every hotel. So this is the kind of philosophical way South Koreans can do something by being a true, genuine, good citizen. And North Koreans say, there is an alternative. We can join with them.
Question right here. Then I'll go there.
Hello. Aditya Banerjee of Asia Society. You mentioned how women were key economic actors in the marketplace in North Korea. I was wondering if you could expand on the role of women culturally, economically, legally in North Korean society.
So you
well, let me, yeah, let me just start by saying, for those who don't know, the reason that the women are more often in the marketplace, and for that matter, the reason that about the women outnumber men as defectors, something like 3-1 these days, is because it's easier for them to escape from the workplace and to actually to stay under the regime's radar and operate by themselves. What it means is that in a lot of households, maybe the majority today, it looks like the women are the main breadwinners, because the men still go to work and earn the useless North Korean money. So this gives the women more power, and reports we get is that that causes all sorts of family problems because North Korea is still a male-dominated society, so the husbands are angry that the women now have more money, more power, and that situation is probably gradually changing, but it's still a big problem in North Korea, and it's very difficult for the women because they have to still have to take care of the family, plus go out and earn the only money that the family's really getting.
And I'll give you a little bit of a Korean story. There is always a phrase of, I don't know whether you know any Chinese, like, forward expressions of describing the, some wisdom and social cultural patterns. And there is expression, the Namnam Bungnyo, means that southern man, northern woman. Korea is a little bit longish, like a running rabbit, and has a kind of like a natural resource division line. North Korea is more forested, more natural resources. South Korea is more aggregation, flat field, bread making. And so that there is a very natural division. And the North Korean woman tends to be a lot more resilient and very hardworking, and also the, a little bit more aggressive than the typical, I should say, very polite and pretty South Korean woman. So that, that has been the expression. And often I was joked by Korean men, because you came from North Korea, you're very tough. So, and the North Korean woman is really, I mean, the, when I see the defectors, most Korean defectors, men in South Korea, they are sick, they are drunkard, they are the unemployed, they are angry and bitter. They talk about the goodness of North Korea, my God's sake. They left that bloody North Korea, and then they now they have a great meal, and then nice food, nice car, and they complain. Women are all hardworking. Women are the manager, traders, businessmen. They are the ones who collect the money and send to North Koreans. So the same pattern happens in South Korea as well.
The woman right there.
Hi, my name is Priscilla from the Center for Defense Information. You mentioned that you don't think that North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons, and I know a lot of the media talks about how North Korea wants to keep it for a bargaining chip, but I wonder if you could talk about perhaps the domestic factors that go into that, because I feel like with the propaganda, they try to create this illusion of unity under the military first policy. And while you were interviewing defectors, did any of them actually say that the nuclear weapons actually legitimize the government's control or the anti-American sentiments at all?
I think defectors generally say they're not the least bit interested in the nuclear situation, as long as it doesn't start a war. But whether the regime has one nuclear weapon or 50, they couldn't. It doesn't touch them, because they're worried about getting food today. So I'm not sure that there's really a domestic factor involved in this. I think it's really the regime figuring out what's best for it. And when I say they're not going to give up nuclear weapons, I'm just relying on history. They probably started developing in the mid-'80s. And why give up something that you've had for such a long time and that served you well? That's what brings the United States to North Korea. That's what brings all the big countries to North Korea, is nuclear weapons. And I think it would be crazy for them to give it up. And I think now, for years, of course, Kim Il-sung said, we have no intention ever of building a nuclear weapon. Why? I mean, the United States has so many. Why would we want one or two? It'd be useless. And then Kim Jong-il, for years and years, has been saying, oh, we want nothing more than to give up our nuclear weapons and denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Now, of course, the official line is, sorry, we can't do that. And I think finally the North Koreans are telling the truth, and we should believe them.
I have a somewhat speculative question. I would hypothesize, as a non-Korea expert, that 60 years or more of the North Korean regime has inflicted terrific psychological damage on the North Korean people in terms of their willingness to engage in meaningful personal relations, trusting each other, having empathy for other people, engaging in civil society. And I would imagine also that when the regime ends, when unification comes, that there will be an initial euphoria, but that this damage is going to linger for some time. Do you agree with that line of thought? And how long will it take for people of Northern Korea to get over this profound damage that's been done to them?
Well, I absolutely agree. It's as if you interviewed the defectors yourself. I mean, when they come to South Korea, that's one of their problems. They can't establish relationships. They have to be so careful in North Korea what they say, you know, to anyone, even inside the family sometimes. And so there's all sorts of psychological problems they have, or suspicion, which isn't necessarily a problem.
How long it lasts, I don't know. I'm not a political scientist, as a psychologist. My rule of thumb had been for, I don't know why, I always thought, well, for every year that you lived under that regime, it's going to take, you know, another year to get over it. So maybe it's going to be 60 years. We can look at Germany and the problems they have even today, and North Korea's got to be much worse situation. Mm-hmm. I'm very pessimistic.
If I add that I had a breakfast with the German ambassador who just arrived in South Korea a couple of weeks ago when I was in Seoul last week, and he's not just a diplomat but also historian and studied the German unification and after unification process. And he and his first secretary, we had a very somber and a very interesting breakfast. And he, because the German Berlin Wall celebration was going on, and so he said, Katie, still going on, the lingering about the Eastern Germans cannot be a member of the real unified Germany, and then the impact and scar, and then nostalgia, and then new rise of socialism, communism. And compared to Germany, he just experiencing the Korea will be about three times longer. And that's what I emphasize, that if South Korea is ever interested in become a strategic player and interested in long-term national goal of unification, today is the day, begin with the embracement, reconciliation, and then the really, truly think about the, how to help poor North Koreans. Because defectors arriving 90s, 20s, and then 21st century, doesn't matter. You lived 10 years ago, 15 years ago, they still carry a impact of indoctrination, and they curse some of the things that they don't like, and I can see the lingering impact of their damage. Yeah.
Thank you. Richard Shin.
Hi, Richard Shin with Economist Incorporated. Thank you for a wonderful presentation. And Katie, you know, we go back to Berkeley back in the 1970s,
yes. Right?
All right, my question is really concerning information. You know, I've read articles where they said, you know, you could talk to a North Korean soldier on a cell phone and, you know, they're bad-mouthing the government. And on the other hand, I read another article that says, you know, if you're found with a, like, Chinese cell phone, you could be severely punished and there's a lot of restrictions. And the same thing with marketplace. You know, there's a lot of market going on, and then next thing you hear is that there's a crackdown and it's suppressed. And so you get all these different types of information, and how do you filter them out to kind of reach a general consensus or general understanding of what's really occurring in North Korea? And second thing is that you also said you interviewed a lot of defectors. And I was wondering, you know, they also have certain views about North Korea, and that's the reason why they defected. So the question is, how do you also put a filter on what they say to get a more reasonable assessment of what's going on in North Korea?
Should I answer?
Well, let me just add. Okay. One thing you do is you look for consistency, of course. That's mm-hmm. just a social science approach to it. And when you get a lot, when you get, you know, three-quarters of the defectors saying this and one-quarter saying that, you go tend to go with this, I think. And we find quite a bit of consistency, I would say. But also, that's interesting that, you know, can they use cell phones? Can't they use cell phones? I mean, both. North Korea is a very complicated country. It's a changing country. And that's why we don't have this unity. And some people can get away with using cell phones and others not. Some even occasionally, some people criticize their government in public and get away with it, where the next week someone will be thrown into prison for that. So both things happen, and that's why it's difficult, I think, to write about North Korea.
Maybe between the punishment and the possession of using the cellular phone is that olden days, let's say about 2003, 4, 5, if you really discovered that you possessed an illegal cellular phone when you crossed the border, or maybe mostly in the edge and the provincial area of Hamgyong province, then they immediately, what the heck did you get? Where did you get? And then did you meet a Korean Christian or a trader? And so somehow they can be beaten, and then to a different degree they can be sent to the camp. But these days, everybody wants money. So basically these guys got a little smarter, saying that, oh, I was just given, you can have it. And then deliver steal the battery functioning, the cellular phone to the security. And he may be a little bit shuddering and trembling, but nonetheless, the guy behind it, yeah, get it. and then the bribery. So it means that the people discovered how to manipulate. And then also constantly the cellular phones at the boat in the China is sometimes underground, they bury and then they use it, and then if the battery is gone, and then they cross the border again. So that's what we call it, individual economy is the number one driving factor.
Woman right here.
I'm Kara Bartlett. I work here at Brookings. I was interested in how you referenced the United Nations report, and I was wondering if the United Nations is met with the same hostility as other individual countries outside world, and also what role the UN can play moving forward for helping the North Korean people.
United Nations.
United Nations. How did we reference that?
You talked about the report that the North Korean government submitted to the UN and the review in December.
Oh, that was Roberta. Roberta said?
That's what Roberta said. Yes, Roberta is an expert.
She's the expert on that. I want to say is that, of course, the official North Korean propaganda line, which they give to their people, is that the United Nations is controlled by the United States, so they don't expect much from them.
But they use the United Nations for the goodwill, for the money, UNDP, and United Nations is a legitimate institution that they have to go through.
Also recall that it was under the flag of the United Nations that our side fought the Korean War.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a UN organization, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that creates a certain amount of trouble on their nuclear program. So the bias is on the negative side, I think. Gentleman in the back.
Thank you. My name is Keith Hill. I'm BNA. My question is, since Dr. Hasek in his presentations mentioned when rather than if unification will occur. My question is, do you think the steps toward unification will increase once Kim Jong-il's son takes over, or will it still be at a low level 10 years after he's in office? Thank you.
Boy, that's such a tough one to predict, right? Everyone's saying, what's going to happen? I take a very pessimistic view, and I think whoever takes over is going to be able to pretty much keep things the way it is. But every succession will reduce the regime's chances of staying in power a little bit. I'm not looking for
it. Well, he's a pessimist. I'm an optimist.
Yeah,
I'm not exactly optimist, but try to take the different stance. Knowing the Korean culture and the Confucian family ethics and all these things. We have a couple of expressions, as I expressed, like a southern man and the northern woman. There is also a very famous expressions in Korea, 부자가 삼대 안 간다, means that even the richest and the healthiest family will not last more than three generations until all three generations are at the equal level of genius and creativity. And basically either the maybe shareholding and the corporate structure will change, and then eventually will be disfranchised and becoming a different corporation and different family. And Kim Jong-un is the 26, and I was the one who created the Tiger Father and Dog Son. Tiger Father was Kim Il-sung, and Dog Son was Kim Jong-il. And Dog Son was actually lasting longer than I expected. And so this one, puppy grandson. And,
you heard it here.
Yeah. Okay. But Kim Jong-il was born at least in the camp of the military camp during the colonial period, when his father was a resistance leader and fighter. Kim Jong-un had an incredible luxurious life, and surrounded by the iPod and the pizza, pasta, and the Geneva schooling, and listening to the classical music. And somehow I think all this kind of like a third wave of third generational information and the lifestyle is not making North Koreans exception. It means he knew it. And so if he become a puppy crown prince, I think that there will be some dissension within the military, in a sense that the process will be not fastened. So I put a little bit more marble than the optimistic scene.
But let me just, as a pessimist, let me just add this idea of a system. I mean, North Korea is not just Kim Jong-un. When he takes over, he may be the number one decision maker, but there are a lot of other people involved, and I think they will, if he decides to make some changes, I think they'll slow him up, my prediction.
Roberta?
I just wanted to comment briefly on the point about the United Nations. The North Korean government seems to be quite ambivalent, really, with regard to the United Nations. I can see this in the human rights area. They have ratified international human rights agreements. They come before some of the UN bodies to answer questions. They have submitted their report to the UN under the Universal Periodic Review of their human rights record, and the report uses the language of international human rights. And they have put these terms in their constitution. On the other hand, they don't cooperate with the UN recommendations. So they kind of come into part of it, and then the UN could do quite a lot to exert influence and pressure, if they would, to try to get North Korea to abide by some of the recommendations, mainly access. They've denied access to the human rights parts of the UN, High Commissioner for Human Rights, etc., but they have allowed in the humanitarian organizations, and of course there's always an ambivalent relationship over monitoring and access. So the UN could be very useful in helping to pry open the country with regard to access, I think. And I hope that the Universal Periodic Review on December 7th will actually have a punchline in getting North Korea to agree to some access for human rights bodies.
No comment. Gentleman next to Roberta.
Will Amatruda. There have been reports in the press that Kim Jong-il's son was educated in a Swiss boarding school. Do you think the reports are accurate, and what do you see as the implications of having eventually a North Korean leader who has personal knowledge of the West?
The Washington Post, Andrew Higgins, who stationed in Paris, by now maybe he went to China as a new correspondent for the Washington Post, went to Geneva. And I suggest him that he would find a very attractive French woman to go to the boarding school, because of obviously that boarding school that Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-chol, they attended the two different schools, were bombarded by the Japanese, Korean, Chinese, Singaporean, Taiwanese, and global media presence. So they were totally spoiled. So, but if he goes with a very nice, attractive French woman speaking French, maybe they open the door. Nonetheless, he wrote an article about 6 months ago, so I don't know. But basically that they attended those schools, and it's a formative age for them, and it's exposed. But of course, Switzerland is, who could say Switzerland is a totally free country? It's a very regimented boarding school, so you can imagine there may be exposure to the local civil society must be very controlled and limited. But nonetheless, I think it has some impact on their inner, the cultural, whatever, the formation, I think. That's my opinion.
And more likely to lead a little bit more to reform, I think. Although Kim Jong-il has surrounded himself with Western products all his life. He loves them, and yet he denies them to his people. So either Kim Jong-un, if he takes power, is going to have to open up the country a little more, or else he's going to have to be more of a, what we call in the book, a double thinker, and live one life, you know, in his palace, and then another life when he's speaking to the people.
Back there.
Thank you very much, Brian Hollingsworth. You mentioned that Kim Jong-il is fascinated by technology but denies it to his people. Orascom, to my knowledge, recently is brokering a deal for a 3G network called Curolink, to my knowledge, and I could be a mistake with the name. How do you explain the will to bring 3G technology and fiber optics into North Korea but yet deny them? How is it possible, do you think, to deny such a powerful medium to the people?
Do you know that? I don't
know. They're introducing the 3G network. That's true.
Yeah.
So in that sense, they're not denying it, but it's extremely expensive. So very few people are going to get it. And my understanding is that you can't make international calls with it. And I suppose all the calls you do make are monitored by the State Security Department. So, Kim Jong-il, from the beginning, realizes one half of his brain, you know, left half or something, I don't know, says, We have to have technology in North Korea, or we're always going to be behind, and this is an important aspect of technology. The other side of his brain says, but boy, if people start calling each other on cell phones, I'm in big trouble because they'll be plotting. So it's this ambivalence again, and I'm skeptical about the expanding cell phone network in North Korea. They clamped down on the last cell phone network, and the same might happen on the Orascom network.
Over here, last question.
Hi, Grace from Institute for Policy Studies. My question is about American media portrayal of North Korea. Do you think there are discrepancies, notable discrepancies, in present circumstances and developments in North Korea and our portrayal in the media of North Korea? And if there is a need for to approach it in a more comprehensive manner?
American media.
Any media problem for that matter.
Do you have any comments?
Well, I mean, we've been studying North Korea for so many years. It hasn't changed that much. It's a pretty dull country, to tell you the truth. That doesn't get into the media. So my only comment would be, really, the media articles and media programs you see tend to suggest that something big is happening in North Korea. Oh, finally, they're finally melting, or there's finally reform, or finally this, or finally that. When in fact, usually that's not the case. It's going to be business as usual, but you got to sell the newspapers or something like that. So we read these articles and we say, I got a good enough memory. I remember reading that article 5 or 10 years ago.
Ralph and Katie, thank you very much for a very illuminating presentation.